It made people do a double take. We're talking about the story of a pharmacy worker at the Waianae Comprehensive Health Center indicted for stealing close to $700,000 worth of diabetic testing strips. At last check, 47-year-old Stacy Lynn Pihana had yet to be arrested, although an Oahu grand jury indicted her last week. The city prosecutor's office tells us it's not illegal to resell test strips if you register with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Pihana is accused of ordering 2,000 cases, destroying the paperwork, and then selling the merchandise to a source who then sold the strips on the black market. The headline shocked officials with the Hawaii office of the American Diabetes Association. L.J. Duenas is the executive director in Honolulu. He spoke with us about the dangers of getting those medical supplies underground.
We have dealt with instances where people with diabetes may not have enough finances to be able to afford products like diabetes test strips. And so, you know, it may be that this market exists because there is that market where, you know, people who can't afford the full price of diabetes test strips have to go elsewhere.
Share with our listeners why it's so important for diabetics to test their blood sugar level.
For people with diabetes, managing their blood sugar levels is very important. It ensures, one, that they are at a healthy blood sugar level, so they avoid hypoglycemia, which means low blood sugar, or hyperglycemia, which means high blood sugar. Hypo or hyperglycemia has short and long-term complications. For instance, with high blood sugar levels, there is complications such as vision impairment or blindness, heart disease, kidney disease or failure, amputation, among many others. And so being able to keep blood sugar levels at a normal range as much as possible is very important for people with diabetes. And in order for them to manage their blood sugar level, they need to know their blood sugar levels at any given time throughout the day, and it's through diabetes test strips and the monitor that comes with these test strips, they're able to do just that.
What is the cost of these items?
Test strips, they range, I would say, between 75 cents to a dollar. You can purchase these test strips over the counter without a prescription. However, in order for insurance to cover these test strips, it will need to come with a prescription prescribed by a physician.
And how many times would a person need to test their blood?
That varies. There are individuals where one or two times a day would be sufficient. However, there are some individuals who have to test up to 12 times, or if not more, in order for them to manage their blood sugar levels throughout the day. For instance, a person with type 2 diabetes may need to test, you know, 1 to 3 times a day or more if they need to. But a person with type 1 diabetes and autoimmune disease, they may need to test more frequently because their body no longer produces insulin, which helps regulate blood sugar levels. So their blood sugar levels, go up and down pretty drastically throughout the day based on activity level, their meal, and whatnot.
So if you're testing your blood a dozen times a day, that could really add up.
It could. It's about $12 to $15 a day if you're purchasing these test strips over the counter. And, you know, not every test strip is going to work. There are a few test strips that will come out of a bunch or, a batch that may not work. So they would have to discard them. Now, the concern that we have with these test strips that may be sold on the black market or whatnot is that, one, they may have not been properly stored. They may have been damaged, or they may be expired, which could not provide the accurate reading that is required to manage blood sugar levels.
And why is that so important? What could happen?
Well, they may get an incorrect reading, and that's not what you would want if you are, for instance, hypoglycemic, where your blood sugar levels are low and the test strip indicates that your blood sugar level is high, you may treat yourself for a high, which would then result in your blood sugar levels even dropping further. And that could put people in a coma or even result in death.
So it really is very important to make sure that what you're using is the integrity is intact. It's reputable. You buy from a reputable place and not just off
Correct.
Craigslist or eBay.
Correct, yes. And, you know, every test strip tube, it usually comes in a tube, has an expiration date. So it's very important that people take a look at their expiration date before using the test strip. Be best if they would purchase from a reputable source, typically a pharmacy or at a drugstore if they're purchasing over the counter. And if they have any questions or if they're in need of assistance in terms of receiving test strips, you know, we provide that service. We can get them in touch with organizations that can provide test strips for free or at a low cost.
And share with our listeners what the state of diabetes is here in Hawaii.
Well, there's about 600,000 people with pre-diabetes or diabetes, and about 155,000 have diagnosed diabetes, 95% of which have type 2 diabetes, the other 5% with type 1 diabetes. And so it's become an epidemic, and our real goal now is to ensure that the 442,000 people with prediabetes have the opportunity to make changes in their life to be able to avoid delay or avoid the onset of a type 2 diabetes diagnosis.
And how does Hawaii stack up nationally?
Well, we rank number 2 in health ranking as reported a few weeks ago, but with diabetes, we're number 25. And so that's pretty shocking. And our population, however, we're prone or we fall under our Screen at 23 campaign, where Asian Americans, although they may appear slim, we actually are at a higher risk of type 2 diabetes due to where fat is deposited in our body. So that in itself increases our risk for type 2 diabetes as a state.
So it might then lend itself to the thought that, okay, we've got a high rate of this disease here, that maybe it wouldn't be surprising that you would have a black market or gray market emerge.
Correct. That is correct. And, you know, like I had shared, it's pretty expensive. Diabetes is a very expensive disease. And, you know, those who have it are typically those who are more vulnerable, who don't have access to adequate or affordable health care. And so our mission here is to make sure that they have adequate and affordable health care.
Well, we have a first case. I'm sure it won't be the last. But thank you, LJ, for joining us on the conversation.
Nope. You're very welcome.
Turns out others in the medical and law enforcement community were equally surprised about the resale market of diabetic test strips. The test strip market had pretty much gone under the radar until this Waianae comp theft case. The large numbers are what made administrators at Queens Medical Center sit up and take notice. Dr. Rick Bruno is vice president of patient care at Queens Medical Center. He says it's more common to hear of the black market with narcotic pain-killing drugs.
I think the biggest concern with respect to medications is you can't be entirely sure what you're getting, whether it's the correct medication, whether it's the correct dose, or even be sure that it's an unadulterated substance so you're actually getting what you think you're getting. From the emergency department, we try to supply the patient with an indicated number. There's quite a bit of work, both locally and nationally, with the pharmacies, with the DEA, to look for high-risk situations where folks either have an inordinate number of prescriptions or unusually high numbers and quantities of pain medications.
But do you see a lot of cases in the ER as a result of these overdoses or maybe a product not being what the patient thought it was?
I don't think that we see a high lot. I think there's just a very high level of vigilance more related to the concern for misuse of pain medications. And so I think the physicians have kind of focused on the issue with respect to ensuring that our prescribing habits are appropriate and folks who are patients who maybe are at risk, we don't overprescribe.
Bruno believes the diabetic test strip black market is more difficult to tackle. Again, Dr. Bruno is the Vice President of Patient Care at Queen's.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the world of dolphins and what they can teach us. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard, we are identifying ocean drifters. Sea jellies are some of the simplest and oldest creatures in the ocean. Also called jellyfish, sea jellies lack brains, hearts, and real eyes, yet they've survived for 650 million years. In Hawaii, we're no stranger to them. Common species include Portuguese man of war, lagoon, moon, white spotted, upside down, and box jellies. Worldwide, at least 200 different species are known. It's a common misconception that all sea jellies are poisonous when actually only 70 species have harmful toxins. The strength of each species' toxin is relative to what they eat. For instance, a moon jelly, which preys on small zooplankton, doesn't need a powerful sting to survive. But the reverse is true for box jellies that prey on small fish and crustaceans. There are several different developmental stages of a sea jelly's life. And for today's quiz, can you tell us the common name for an adult sea jelly? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
We know that dolphins are highly intelligent and extremely intuitive, with a highly developed sense of play and an elaborate social organization. We may even wonder if they're having a better time than we are. It certainly looks that way. Kauai's Dolphin Touch Wellness Center is built on the premise that we can learn a great deal from our cetacean counterparts. The dolphin consciousness offers a kind of template for our own. Jeannie Russell is a self-described creator of Dolphin Touch Therapy. She's on the line with us from Kapa'a. Good morning, Jeannie.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, sure. What got you on this path in the first place?
It's been a long journey. I've always felt connected to the dolphins and felt they're just curious about them. And as a child, I did a report on dolphins and was, to my amazement, realize that the size of a dolphin brain is comparable, if not larger, to our brain with mm-hmm. proportion to our body size.
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally fascinated by that because I knew a dog's brain is about the size of a pea. And I was like, wow, what is it about these dolphins? And ever since then, I've had this fascination to learn more about them. But what really started me on the journey is when my husband had fallen ill, and I started doing energy work on him.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Reiki practitioner at the time, If you're familiar with Reiki.
Well, fill me in a little bit, would you, Jeannie? What is what you describe as energy work?
So basically, let's say you have pain in your elbow. So what that is, that's blocked energy. That energy is not flowing through the meridians very well. So it's difficult for you to feel the meridians open and flowing easily through that area. So when a Reiki practitioner works on your elbow, what they are doing is they're pushing through that blockage so that the energy can flow freely through the meridians.
Physically pushing on the elbow muscles, or how does that energy get transferred?
Well, it can be done energetically, you know, above the body. It doesn't actually need to be touching the body, and actually can be done with distance healing. But it's all about intention and having that move the energy through that meridian. We know that everything is energy. The table, the chair, everything we're feeling, our emotions. Energy is all around us. It's just in Einstein's words, it cannot be created or destroyed. It's just transformed.
So, Jeannie, what you're saying is that the energy, with a powerful intention, energy can be kind of transferred through the air?
Yes, exactly.
And that's exactly. The Reiki. So how does this become, how does this get from dolphins to humans? What are the lessons that dolphins teach us?
So what happened was I was doing the Reiki work on my husband who had been ill, and when I did that, all of a sudden the dolphins energetically showed up, and what that did is it took Reiki on steroids. It was like times 10, the energy and the vibration that was moving that energy through, and that's what the dolphins bring. The dolphins bring that energetic, higher vibrational experience to all of our healings and our practices, and it's that joy, that connection to the heart chakra that they are so in tune with, and they're in that state all the time.
Well, Jeannie, how does that connection get made? That's what I'm trying to understand. Do you go in the water? How does that connection to dolphin consciousness come into your consciousness? When you said dolphins, you were doing Reiki on your husband, and then dolphin consciousness came along. What form did that take?
It came in the etheric form.
In the what?
Etheric, in the energetic form. Energetically, I felt the dolphins here as if they were in the room with me. It's an energetic connection to the dolphin energy. So the dolphins are multidimensional beings. They're beings that are, they can shapeshift and transform. They can be in different places. So you can feel, just like when you're feeling the presence of an ascended master or an angel or that kind of feeling, it's like, you know, some people will feel Archangel Michael, you know, their presence with them. I just have that connection with the dolphins where I feel their energy on that energetic level.
How do you know? How do you know that that's where that energy is coming from?
Well, I visualize in my third eye, I visually see the dolphins, and it's in my third eye, and people that I've worked with, and I haven't even shared or, you know, just done with, when they get off the table, because I'm working on a Reiki table, they will say that they saw dolphins, or sometimes they'll connect with turtles or monk seals, you know, but they will see, they've shared with me that they see in their vision while they're lying down on the table, they've also seen the dolphins, they've felt the dolphins. And this is not something that is very common for them to experience, and yet they share it with me as, wow, this is amazing, I felt the dolphins when we were on the table with you. And so they were, that's the transcription of how it works. It might be a little abstract to some of your listeners or some people, but really it's just another energy form. And because we're not actually touching the dolphins, because we're not actually being with the dolphins, you can still connect with them. You can still connect with their energy. You connect with their joy. You can connect with their playfulness.
Well, Jeannie,
it's very hard when people...
Jeannie, thanks very much. We've got to go, but thanks for talking with us. Jeannie Russell is the creator of Dolphin Touch Therapy and the owner of the Dolphin Touch Wellness Center in Kapa'a, Kauai. The center offers a free health fair the first Saturday of every month from 1 to 7 p.m.
Time now for our daily dose of reality with Civil Beat's Chad Blair. Hawaii has barely got its medical marijuana dispensaries off the ground. Now the news about the Trump administration giving states the green light to prosecute marijuana cases. Good morning, Chad.
Oh, hello, Catherine.
Quite a story.
Yeah, and, you know, I think I'm afraid of the reality check today is we don't know exactly how this is going to play out. You remember the Obama administration, they backed off, really a hands-off approach when it came to having the feds interfere with states that had either recreational marijuana laws or decriminalized for, or rather for medical marijuana. We just don't quite know how this is going to play out. Right now, the last count I checked, Catherine, I think 29 states now have some form of legalized pot, either recreational. California, I think, became just the eighth state this week to allow that, or medical marijuana, which, as you know, we in Hawaii have had, and you mentioned the dispensary. So there's some saying that the Sessions, Jeff Sessions' move might actually start a national conversation about whether we should move to decriminalization.
Right, because like you mentioned, so many states have some form of legal marijuana.
You know, I could tell you that our congressional delegation, all four of them were really pretty upset, particularly Tulsi Gabbard. She's actually got a resolution in the House that would change the Schedule One status of marijuana. You know what that means, right? That means marijuana is ranked, classified, along with heroin and LSD and ecstasy, I believe. And she's been pushing to say that should not be a Schedule One drug. It's ridiculous. And she said yesterday that, look, this is an outdated policy the federal government has when it comes to marijuana. We're wasting a lot of money. We're tearing up families. So one wonders whether there might actually be a push in Congress. By the way, it's not just Democrats. There's a lot of Republicans that are upset with Jeff Sessions, who, of course, is a Republican attorney general.
Right, but we haven't heard yet back from the attorney general here, have we? Or the governor?
Well, the governor has not spoken out. I know that the attorney general has expressed some concerns about how this is going to work. Our attorney general has been not shy at all, of course, about challenging the Department of Justice and other issues. We do have in place a highly regulated program for medical marijuana, and we do know that the Ninth Circuit ruled not long ago, the Ninth Circuit includes Hawaii and the Western states, said, look, the Department of Justice can't interfere with a state's medical pot laws. Now, how will that play out with recreational marijuana? I don't know. And one wonders is that if that's what Sessions is really focused on. But I would imagine the resistance will be strong. And because the state has set up its system for medical marijuana, perhaps there will not be as big of an impact. But again, the reality check is nobody really knows where this is going to go.
All right. Okay, well, that was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check from Civil Beat.
Aloha, I'm Drew from Paradise Cove. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
At this point in our program on Friday, we check in with our news director, Bill Dorman. And Bill, as we just heard in the Civil Beat story, marijuana continues to exist in a kind of a shaky environment.
Yeah, it's really been an interesting development with Jeff Sessions coming out, rescinding that directive from the Obama administration,
right,
instructing federal prosecutors to kind of play that down. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, you have the medical marijuana process continuing to roll out here in Hawaii. And, and as you know, and as we've been following along on this show and in news pieces as well, the dispensary program, meanwhile, still keeps, rolling out and keeps developing. So now, State Department of Health says there should be another two dispensaries coming online within the next couple of months, and they have sort of a growth pattern of expecting a couple more, maybe, you know, later in the year as well, a couple, 2-3 months after that. The Sessions question, really, as Chad was alluding to, is sort of hanging over all of this. There's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the impact. But meanwhile, as you know, policymakers still need to, and the people executing the policy still need to go ahead and plan to get this done. So Kuvehi Hiraishi is looking into this in terms of not just from the perspective of the dispensaries themselves, but also, meanwhile, the patients, you know, the end users on all of this and sort of seeing what's going to be up with that.
And meanwhile, these businesses who thought they were going to have a fairly easy time getting off the ground are having a very shaky liftoff.
Yeah, talk about a business plan with some holes in it and some questions some uncertainties. That's really changed that around for sure.
You're also taking a different kind of look at the Honolulu Museum of Art.
Yeah, so, you know, Museum of Art, of course, do fine work in terms of exhibits and various things, and Noe Tanigawa always follows that strand of things. Sean O'Hare has been the director there for about a year, and Noe's going to check in with him on a pretty wide range of topics. Of course, the museum itself and things in progress, but also this idea of fundraising, how that's going for them and what that may mean for elsewhere, for folks who are raising money, be it nonprofits, cultural institutions around the state.
That's frequently kind of a year-end discussion, but this year does seem more fraught than ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a big week in Korea next week. Who knew?
Yeah, exactly. North-South Korea getting together. We'll see what they talk about on Tuesday and how that plays out. Also plays to a U.S. side of that story as well. We'll have more on that next week.
Good. Thanks, Bill.
You bet.
And now it's time for us to delve into our mailbag and share your feedback. Following our economy panel discussion with UHERO's Carl Bonham and DBED's Luis Salaveria, we heard this.
My name is Michael. I'm calling from the Big Island. In Hawaii, especially for you guys, in Honolulu and the surrounding area, we're at a point in time where housing is prohibitively expensive for regular working class people. So affordable housing is a huge thing. And can we get the local governments behind more streamlined, efficient ways of permitting and processing some tiny houses or alternative style housing? That's my thoughts on it. Have a beautiful day. Aloha.
Herman Goldman of 3D Builders and Design, Inc. says, if you give the financial break, such as tax credits, to those on the lower income scale, say the top 80%, I believe that most of that extra money will be spent helping businesses. This is trickle-up economics. Might be flood-up, but given the weather here for the last few days.
After yesterday's panel discussion of Hawaii's minimum wage, Robert B. wrote this on our Facebook page. The concept of a living wage is a vaporous subject. I'm guessing homeless on the streets have one idea, and people living in beachfront homes have a different idea.
And Roxanne Darling from Maui sent us this question via Twitter. Does a higher wage reduce turnover? If so, how is that cost savings factored in? To get an answer, we called one of our panelists from yesterday's program. Tom Jones is president and co-founder of Gyutaku Restaurants and a former chair of the Hawaii Restaurant Association.
Absolutely, higher wages can reduce employee turnover. And in the long run, turnover can reduce and contribute to decreasing the following expenses: recruiting and hiring costs, onboarding and training costs, some operating expenses, and a reduction in direct cost of mistakes or work errors. And then also, too, and this is really important, the time it takes to recover from errors with customers, because you have to contact guests and talk to them about problems and make good with them. So those are all areas that you can reduce costs. And then, I think moreover, and the most important thing is it can also increase worker productivity and therefore customer satisfaction and help increase your top line and your bottom line.
Thanks for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
New information about Hawaii's aging bridges. The state ranking on the high-risk bridges is now online. You may have heard about how you can find details about state highway construction projects. Now there's a new section just on bridges, and what's online may surprise you. DOT's Ed Sniffen oversees state highways and bridges with more on the state of our bridges.
We just added the bridge tab just recently, and this is one of the biggest ones. Although pavement condition is a big concern for the public, usually when they're going to and driving our route, the bridges are, for us, one of the biggest concerns. These provide the connections for all of our pavement areas. And although they are short in distance in relation to the pavement, without those connections, the routes are just inaccessible. So for us, this is a big focus for the program, not only from a practical perspective for people using the roadways itself, but also from a programming perspective from the federal government. We're operating under a mandate by the federal government that we have to hit certain performance measures in order to ensure that our program stays in a high level of maintenance. If we don't hit those performance measures, then we risk losing federal funding in the future. So all of this is setting up towards those performance measures that we would submit to the federal government by October 2018 to set those how we're going to perform in the future.
I saw that they released a report about the state of our nation's bridges, and it did look at Hawaii. Which said that we're close to 6% of our bridges were structurally deficient, and that it would cost about $1 billion to fix them all.
So if we're looking at fixing all the bridges on our system, it's actually more than that. For us, when we look at our system, we've got about 741 bridges. High-volume areas on Oahu would be about 300 that we would have to make sure that we kept up to speed. Now, when we say a bridge is structurally deficient, it's just the identification that one or more structural elements are out of compliance of the new standards. So that doesn't mean the bridge is unsafe. It doesn't mean it's not usable. It just means it's out of compliance from today's standards. If a bridge was designed 50 years ago, which is a lot of our bridges on the system, they're going to be out of compliance. So that's kind of what that means. But for us, when we rank the bridges throughout our system on the 1 to 50, that's what you find on the tab, random based on its performance now, structural performance now, the volumes that go through the area now, the potentials that if it gets cut off, there would be no other access points in those areas, those types of things.
Right, so, and I did hit the tabs, and I looked at all the islands, and really most of them are here on Oahu.
Oh, yes, there's quite a bit of them. Although the Hawaii Island is the biggest infrastructure that we have, most of our bridges are right on Oahu. And that's just the state system. There's still another 230 or so county bridges that we've got to consider.
When we look at the Big Island, I know you have the potential for really shutting off a lot of communities, like let's say along the Hamakua coast. And Big Island is a big island, so you'd really have far to go if some of those bridges were to be impassable.
Exactly. And you know the Big Island better than most. And you look at those bridges in those areas, especially on the Hamakua coast, they're like 50 to 70 feet off the ground. So the construction or the rehab of those bridges are definitely extremely complex and really expensive, which is why it makes it so difficult for us to prioritize the program. When we're looking at the system that we have, the legacy system that we have, and we're trying to get it up to a higher level of maintenance, prioritizing need in areas where our need exceeds our funding gets a little more difficult. So we're trying to see which bridges we absolutely have to reconstruct, which bridges we could potentially just rehabilitate, which bridges we could just make adjustments to have the life cycle last another 10, 20 years for us, and which bridges we could defer for now to make sure we can focus on the ones that are important. So that's the information that we try to get out to the public on this.
Where are the top three bridges of concern? They hear on Oahu.
Yeah, the top three are on Oahu. Number one and two on the system are the Makaha bridges. You know those wooden bridges out on the leeward coast?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are the top one and two bridges on the system. We have that targeted for 2018 advertising for construction right now. But they're the highest ranking right now because they're wooden. They're in poor condition. If they're cut off or if they go down, that area beyond going west is all cut off. That's why those are two highest priorities.
Right, because you can't exactly go around Ka'ana Point.
Exactly. And number three is Waikoko Bridge, Waikoko Stream Bridge. Actually, that one is on Kuyo Highway. So that one is kind of a toss-up between Waikoko, Waipa, and the Pensacola Relief Drain on Ala Moana that's being repaired right now. Those all kind of scored in the same range.
And what about the funding to fix these bridges? Because we heard a lot about infrastructure with the Trump administration coming in a year ago, and that was where he wanted to focus, is, you know, dealing with these poor roads, highways, bridges, dams. Is there any more money that we could tap into?
No, there hasn't been. And that's been the great thing is the Trump administration is talking about the importance of infrastructure. The difficulty right now is nobody's identified any additional funding that will come to the program. The only funding that we get from the federal government at this time comes through the FAST Act that funds us. So we get about $178 million per year that we use statewide to take care of all of our issues on transportation. For the bridge portion, we would definitely love to get additional funding, but there hasn't been anything identified at this time by the new administration, which is why we keep pushing. This is going to be the third year we do it now. We're trying to push again for additional revenues into the state side of the highways program to see if we can do more of our improvements sooner rather than later.
That's right. You wanted to hike the fuel tax.
Yeah, so the two things. So we're looking at an increase in revenues of about $100 million. So we're looking at fuel tax, registration fees, weight tax in those different areas to try and see if there could be a balance of additional fees to the public that could raise that kind of capital for our program.
Right, and you made the case for that last year, but then this is a election year, so what are the odds?
Well, and that's the thing. We'll try again. And if we're not successful in getting additional funds, that's fine, and because that's the will of the people. But we want to make sure that we have these conversations, ensure that everybody understands what the needs are and how we'll have to adjust the program if additional funding doesn't come in. Doesn't mean we're not going to do our job. We'll just do it a little differently.
Is there anything else that might affect the priority list for our bridges?
The biggest things that we look at, of course, when we start looking at the bridge prioritization themselves is the structural integrity or the condition of the bridge. But we also throw in or look at other things that we already have on those tabs for the public. Definitely the volumes that go through the area is a big consideration. Definitely the land use in that area is a big consideration. And definitely the condition of the pavement that's approaching the bridges is also big. If we can look at a corridor project that takes care of both pavement and bridge at the same time, that's the most efficient we can get. We definitely look at the detour routes that are available, if any. If we're in an area where there's several detours available, and that bridge generally would drop in prioritization. If it's an area like on the leeward coast, then that's your only access. It definitely goes up.
Right, because you don't want to isolate those communities.
Absolutely.
There are also some areas that I saw that bridges that were flagged as being in poor shape. I think along mm-hmm. Nimitz and over in Haula.
We're trying to get better at locating the bridges for the public so they can either use the stream lane or the cross street in the area, or the bridge name itself. We're trying to add more of that information in there.
Right. And then, for example, the case of Haula, where you might have maybe erosion
mm-hmm.
eating away at the highway, the roadway, and the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So that would...
So in those areas, we would definitely rank the bridge itself. There's going to be more information that we start putting on the website very, very soon. And shoreline protection is one of them, how we prioritize the shoreline areas that we're going to protect sooner rather than later, in the midterm and the long term. We'll be putting in a rock fall protection slides as well so that everybody understands what our prioritization for rock fall protections are going to be. Major accident data will be added in. So it's not just the fatality that we look at, but all major accidents that occur on the route itself. Putting in maintenance schedules so people understand where our crews will be at different times throughout the year. And definitely, we're putting in a crowdsourcing app very soon that will allow the public to enter information directly into DOT when they see something on our system. So they can just snap a picture off, send it back to us with some comments that either are preset or something to add in, so we can respond to it sooner rather than later.
Ed Sniffen is the administrator for the State Department of Transportation's Highways Division. You can find a link to the department's bridge management website on the Conversation Facebook page.
Earlier in the show, we asked you for the common name of an adult sea jelly known as pololea in Hawaii. We're no stranger to these invertebrates, and with common sightings of Portuguese men of war and white-spotted jellies, sea jellies have been swimming the world's oceans for 650 million years, and their numbers are continuing to grow unchecked. Many scientists believe that's due to overfishing of our ocean's resources. Adult jellies, with their numerous tentacles and oral arms, are named medusas, after the figure from Greek mythology. Medusas represent one part of the sea jelly's complex life cycle. Starting as fertilized eggs, they develop into larvae, which turn into a polyp when it makes contact with a solid surface. The polyp can then asexually divide and create clones that then split into disc-shaped segments that peel off one at a time and become young and flat sea jellies.
And today we have a winner. Congratulations to Max, who's 9 years old. He called in with his mom, Michelle, in Honolulu. You had the fastest fingers. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2018 Hawaii Literacy Innovation Conference features Dr. Doug Fisher, January 29th through February 1st. Achieve3000.com/community/events.
James McCarthy lives squarely within the troubadour tradition, where a singer and songwriter is expected to be a kind of messenger as well, with storytelling at the center of his art. James is bringing songs and stories of the season to our Atherton Performing Arts Studio tomorrow evening, and he's with us in our studio, guitar in hand. Good morning, James.
Hi, Chris. Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
This is very much, the instrument itself is very much part of it, because guitar players, singers, songwriters are by their nature on the move, right? Kind of nomadic.
Yeah, that's kind of how I started out, hitting the road with a guitar and a backpack and hitchhiking around the country and kind of trying to see what Woody Guthrie was all about after learning a lot about other singer-songwriters who had followed in his footsteps.
Sure. And American history is full of those guys. Jimmy Rogers, the singing brakeman, all the blues artists, right?
Yeah, rock and tourism. And, you know, being a rock and tour is very much a part of, you know, what appeals to us for some reason. And there's not only this kind of carrying forward a cultural historical strain, there's also this really wacky part that I relate to very strongly as a, you know, improvisational actor.
Well, you can kind of get up there with your guitar and sort of follow your muse wherever it leads you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you want to craft the evening and the event for people so that they come away at the end after being through many twists and turns of emotions, having some, you know, having a smile on their face and some interesting new thoughts in their head. Because, I mean, the guys that I learned from, like pretty much at the feet of at in places like the Main Point in Philadelphia and the Philly Folk Festival, like John Prine and Garnet Rogers and Gamble Rogers and Dave Van Ronk, Utah Phillips. Those guys were just so impressive, the ability to enthrall thousands of people just sitting there.
As much about the persona as the music.
Well, I hope that works for me.
But that's what you're putting over the footlights. You're not just doing a bunch of songs.
Right, yeah, yeah. It's how it's all tied together. And I think, in the words of my my mentor, Frank Baker, who was an amazing voice teacher, he always said, you know, that singing was 98% speaking. So when you're singing, you're telling as well.
Mm-hmm. And if you lose that that narrative point, then it's just sort of mush, you know. It's just kind of a melody without a lot of meaning, yeah?
Yeah, it can happen. It's hard to not let it happen, but once you feel it, you know, then you know where you're going pretty much all the time, you know.
Well, you're bringing some Twelfth Night songs to the Atherton.
Yeah, Twelfth Night vibe, you know. The idea was around for a long time, and then Shakespeare's Twelfth Night is certainly not just a Christmas play. It's just this really inventive, you know, adventure, and so I think we're going to have a bit of that. We'll have a good time. It'll be pretty neat. Play some original stuff and some stories and some seasonal things.
Let's hear a sample song.
As I walk down the road at set of sun, the lambs were coming homeward one by one. I heard a sheep bell softly calling them along the little road to Bethlehem. Beside an open door as I drew nigh, heard sweet Mary sing a lullaby. She sang about the lambs at close of day, and rocked her tiny boy among the hay. Beside the door a silver sheep bell rang. The lambs are coming home, sweet Mary sang. Your star of gold is shining in the sky. So hush now, little boy, the lullaby.
Where'd you get that song?
That's from the singing of Sean Colvin. I'm not quite sure who wrote it, but it's a beautiful tune. So
yeah, I never heard it before. Lovely tune.
Yeah, always looking for new holiday ones.
Hey, we've got a couple minutes. Well, let's see if we can sneak in a little bit of another song. You got one in mind?
Sure. This one was inspired by being on the movie To End All Wars, and one day when I came in on the call sheet, it said bug wrangler. I was like, what's that? And they had this guy that came in. He was controlling the insects that were going to go on Kiefer Sutherland's face during a torture
That's
scene.
That's a pretty important job.
Yeah, it's a pretty important job. He had a little like sphere, he wore it around his neck, and the bugs were in there, and they put him on Kiefer's face. I got to know Kiefer a little bit. I learned a lot from him. Good fella. So this goes out to bug wrangler.
Okay.
You can take you and your little tykes from Chaco Canyon all the way up to Cheyenne. You might heard tell of a fellow that's known in the hearts and the minds of the people, but he's more rarely, well, actually nobody's ever sung about him, so I thought I'd give it a try. Yeah, he stewed his mama's hugs, lying on the living room rug, collecting lots of little bugs, the bug wrangler. Down among the stems and reeds, wrangling up some centipedes, enticing them with guts and seeds, bug wrangler. He started out small and stayed that way. He's gonna wrangle bugs till his dying day. Cha! B-U-G-W-R-A-N-G-L-E-R. He wasn't afraid of their pins and needles. If he saw a bug he liked, he'd wheedle it by singing a song sung by the Beatles. Bug wrangler, get it? From Ecuador to El Paso and Beijing to Burkina Faso, with his magic tiny lasso, bug wrangler. He started out small and stayed that way. He's gonna wrangle bugs till his dying day.
W-R-A-N-G-L-E-R. That's a strangely moving song.
I'm glad it touched you.
Well, you know, you get so tired of hearing songs about moon and June and honeymoon.
Exactly.
And, who writes songs about bug ranches?
That's what I thought, too.
Well, you know, it's great for sometimes for an artist to find a gap and then fill it, and you clearly did.
Thanks.
We'll look forward to your concert tomorrow night. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Honolulu singer, songwriter, storyteller James McCarthy. Almost called you James Wrangler. James McCarthy caps off the holiday season with a performance of traditional and original music and stories in Hawaii Public Radio's Atherton Studio. That's tomorrow evening, and it's a celebration of Twelfth Night.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Moyer Financial and Kaiser Permanente.
To us, the word legacy embodies the passion and dedication of people who have named HPR in their wills or estates. This is a special group of visionary friends whose foresight and support at any giving level will help HPR continue our mission for generations to come. If you would like more information about a planned gift to support the programming you've come to love, please call the station during business hours. Thank you.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Join us next week, because January 14th will mark the six-month anniversary of the Marco Polo condominium fire, and we're wondering where we are now on issues raised by this event. High-rise resident safety, real estate values, politics. Tune in next week for a series of follow-up discussions.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
If you missed part of The Conversation or any other show we air, you can find them all on the HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
The Backyard Theme Quiz was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation.